WFNI, WIBC HD2, W298BB, Indianapolis.
AJ
from the racing capital of the world.
Parker Wentz ready.
This is the talk of Gasoline Alley.
For Al Unser, winner of the...
Brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice.
Contact wins it by less than one-tenth of a second.
Now, here's the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson, and Greg Rakestraw.
We welcome you back. And yesterday, Donald and I had the privilege and the surprise of doing live qualification coverage here on 107.5 FM and 1070 The Fan. Today's schedule went a little more according to Hoyle, and so we will be largely taking your telephone calls and your emails on questions of a nostalgic or historic nature about all things Indianapolis Motor Speedway with the official historian of the Brickyard, Donald Davidson. The telephone number is available to you now at 239-1070. Go ahead and get in line and line up with your questions for Donald. Now, Kevin Lee already has a stack of emails, but unfortunately, Kevin has them with him and not me. So you can get to the front of the line on emails for tonight's show. We'll be here until 8 o'clock by emailing my account, greg@1070thefan.com, with your questions for Donald, and we will use them this evening. First of all, a very quick recap, because, again, we did not have a qualifications attempt over the last 4.5 hours plus today at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Michelle Jourdain Jr. could simply never find the speed. And finally, at about 5:45, the Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan team put the car on the hook, towed it back to the garage, did not try to make a final desperation attempt at qualifying. So the 9 drivers who qualified in the first hour of today were never seriously threatened as far as their spots in the field. So quickly, row 9, Joseph Newgarden, Graham Rahal, Sebastian Saavedra. Row 10, Tristan Vaudier, Anna Beatrice, Pippa Mann. And row 11, Connor Daly, Buddy Lazier, and Catherine Legg. And I will actually throw out the first question before we get to our first telephone caller, who will be John. Catherine Legg did not have any lap time in the car until today, and she qualifies for the 97th running of the Indianapolis 500. I'm sure there are multiple stories like this in history, Donald, as far as drivers who had no seat time until the day they qualified and put the car in the show. Who are some other examples along with Catherine?
Probably the best example. She did end up getting quite a number of practice laps. I think she ended up with like 50 for the day. But the point was that from the time that she took off, her third time by was 197. So it's just getting comfortable. The next lap was 210, then 216. The sixth lap that she turned was 220 miles an hour. But anyway, I think probably the finest example I remember was George Snyder, who was famed for being able to get into a car with very little practice and be able to qualify it. And he did not enjoy doing that. He would like to have had more time, but it worked out that way. Well, in 1981, it was never said whether Snyder was going to run or not. And as it's coming down to the final weekend, it became Saturday, and he still wasn't told by Foyt until the final qualifying day that morning. He said, well, do you feel racy? You want to give it a shot? So anyway, when the car was pushed, came out for the very first time. Now, Snyder had been injured during the previous summer, so it had been several months that he'd been in a race car, period. And so they rolled the car out, and the weather was moving in. And it seems to me that there was maybe around 3 o'clock in the afternoon or thereabouts, the weather was moving in, and the line formed, because there was a lot of cars, way more than 33. And so anyway, Snyder's car was put in line. And because what they had figured out was a bunch of cars went through and made qualifying attempts, and then finally they stuck it on the line. That was it. Because they figured out in those days, 1981, you could still do up to 3 warm-ups. And so they figured, well, we could go through once, take the 3 laps and not take the green, and we won't be charged for an attempt, and we'll have at least one hot lap in there. So anyway, when it came through the line, the crew told the officials this is not, we're not going to, they told him what they were doing. They said, we're not going to take the green on this one. And so the officials were told, around on the various loops, this is not going to be an attempt. And then to everyone's amazement, Snyder comes by at the end of the third lap, and the green comes out. And what happened was the crew had been timing him, and he was running so fast, they thought, let's let him make a shot at it. And he went through and turned the four laps and qualified. And so I think with the three warm-ups, he had like eight laps, including the cool-off lap, to come in, and he made it. And I thought that was extraordinary. Now, I mean, there was some question as to whether the boost was exactly what it was supposed to be or whether maybe there was just like a little bit of a margin there or not. But even so, I think to have come from not having run a race car of any kind. And by the way, Catherine Legge apparently has run quite recently. She ran the Delta Wing sports car. But anyway, George Snyder, I think it was like 6 or 7 months since he had driven anything. And the third lap, he's taken the green flag and qualified for the 500. And a follow-up to that, it ended up that he didn't drive in the race because an arrangement was made with Tim Richmond's people. Tim Richmond got bumped, and so they went to Foyt and said, is there a possibility that you could do a driver switch and put Tim Richmond in it? And Foyt said, well, Snyder qualified the car. You'll have to go talk to him. And Snyder said, it's okay with me. They made an arrangement with him. There was a financial consideration.
Uh-huh.
And so he was being paid to not run. And then when I asked him about it sometime later, he said, well, I didn't really know what to do, because he said, I'd been coming back here since 1965. And every year I was in the race. I didn't know what to do. And he said, so I helped push the car out onto the grid. And then he said, I went down and I watched the start from the inside of turn one. And then he said, I went to the pits. And I finally went back to the garage area. And he said, I didn't really pay much attention the rest of the day. And so I said, well, but, you got paid for not running. He said, I would never do that again. Which I thought was pretty interesting.
Again, just part of the great history we talk about here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Let's get to our first telephone caller. It is John in Noblesville. John, thanks for dialing us up. Please go ahead with your question for Donald.
Sure. Thank you so much. And, Donald, I did have a driver I wanted you to profile, but as Greg was going through the last nine, something hit me in that Buddy Lazier is a former winner that's in the last row from qualifying. I know Mario did, have to go to the back row when he had Wally Dallenbach qualify for him, but I don't know if there's been any other former winners that have actually on time started in the back row. I'm sure there are, but I can't think of any.
I would say that there have been, but Mario, actually that happened twice where there was a driver switch. In 78, Mike Hiss qualified for him because he was got into a rain problem trying to driving a Grand Prix and ended up winning the World Championship that year. But anyway, so he went to 33rd because of a driver switch.
Right.
And then the other one you mentioned in 81, similar situation, and Dallenbach qualified the car for him. So that happened twice. But for somebody to actually, for a former winner to qualify for the last row, all right, Johnny Parsons in 1952. Parsons in 52 was going to drive a Ferrari, but it was not comfortable in it. And then in the meantime, Mike Nazarek, they used to jump around all over the place in those days. Mike Nazarek, who had finished second in 51 with the car with which Parsons had won in 50, went to another car, and then Parsons qualified his 50 winner for 31st in 52. I could probably go through and think. I can't imagine that was the only one, but at the moment, that's the only one I can think of.
I was thinking of Sneba, but he was in 1980, and that was also due to a wreck. I think he had to go to the back, and he wasn't a champion at that time. So that was.
That's also correct. He was not a former winner. Yeah.
Yeah. A driver I've been hearing a lot about on your shows over the years, and I just don't know a lot about him, and I was wondering if you could profile him. Jack McGrath?
Okay, yes. Jack McGrath was, I think that most people you talk to, that if you assume that Bill Vukovich was the man, of the first half of the 1950s, and there's no question about that. I think if you were to say, well, who was the closest rival, I believe that would be McGrath. And McGrath was a fabulous qualifier. He was the 54 pole winner, and he also started on the outside of the third row. He never started in the middle of the row, but he started on the outside of the front row in 1949 in a dirt car, and then 51, 52, was on the pole in 54, and then on the outside of the front row for his last start in 55. And we did told a story a couple of hours ago about why McGrath was on the outside of the front row, because he was actually the fastest qualifier. So he was the 1-4 lap track record holder in 54, and then broke his own records in 55, but didn't start on the pole. But third in 54 was his best finish. He was within just a few seconds of catching Jimmy Bryan for what would have been second place. He won championship races, but he just seemed to have the speedway figured out. And but the results don't show that. He was his own chief mechanic. And at a time when you now had to nominate a chief mechanic other than driver, and so he had a fellow named Harold Brown was listed as the chief mechanic, but in fact it was McGrath. I mean, he tore down and put back together his own equipment. He and Manny Aiello were extremely good friends, and in fact, when McGrath suffered from leg cramps in the 51 race, and they made a stop and a driver switch at the halfway point, and Aiello was able to finish third with the car. When I said McGrath was third in 54, he also would get credit for third in 51. But beyond being his own chief mechanic, he was extremely personable. And I've told several people about this. I don't know that I've mentioned this one on the air. Maybe I have. But I had lunch a few years ago with Tom Carnegie and his wife. And I'd never had lunch with him, and although I'd spent a lot of time with him, and the wife I really didn't know at all, hardly. And so they started talking, and it came up that of all the drivers, I thought it was the Unsers, because Tom Carnegie was very fond of Jim Clark and very fond of the Unsers. And one of them made the statement, of all the drivers, the one that we liked the best was Jack McGrath. So just an absolute gentleman. And then he sadly lost his life, which was so common back then. Correct. All of the great drivers, it was, sooner or later you were going to get injured or worse. And supposedly he was going to stop racing except just for the 500 for 1956. And in the very last Triple-A championship race ever held was Phoenix on the Old Mile, not PIR, but the fairgrounds downtown, Arizona State Fairgrounds. And he was fatally at, what was it, lap 84, lap 87 or something like that. He was fatally injured.
Hey, John, thank you so much for your question about Jack McGrath, and even kind of modifying the question given Buddy Lazier's qualifying effort today, as he will start part of the back row party, if you will, middle of row number 11, 32nd fastest of the 33 cars to qualify today. Plenty of callers on hold and some great questions coming in via email as well. We'll get to more of those when we come back. You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 FM and 1070 The Fan.
The Talk of Gasoline Alley is brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry, skilled on principle, union by choice.
Practice and qualifying activity are done for the day here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Michelle Jourdain Jr., the only driver that really took significant laps of practice over the course of this week that did not qualify for the 97th running of the Indianapolis 500. So our conversation now has somewhat shifted toward the days of yesteryear. Your questions for track historian Donald Davidson at 239-1070. I think you can also email your questions to us as well, greg@1070thefan.com. Our last caller from Noblesville asked us about Jack McGrath. I know you had some follow-up information.
I did. He also was a very successful stock car driver. and had a Hudson Hornet at one time, which he kept in a garage in Speedway when drivers used to live in Indianapolis or live in the Speedway area. And in fact, Johnny Parsons and he, the 1950 winner, they stayed in the same house, I think on 12th Street, I believe it was, and they actually walked to the track on race morning. And then apparently as they came up Georgetown Road and then across the track, as you used to do, to go into the infield, it was very close to where the old Victory Lane was, which is the south end of the pits. And either Parsons or McGrath said, you know, maybe in a few hours' time, either you or me are going to be in there, and Parsons was. But anyway, McGrath was a very successful stock car driver and won several races at Milwaukee, both as on dirt, and then the final AAA stock car race at Milwaukee in 1955 was a 200-miler on the fairly recently paved track, and McGrath won that as well. And I met his sister about 4 or 5 years ago, and her name was Betty Carstairs, and she was a very fine golfer, and I didn't know about her, and she didn't know a great deal about racing, and apparently she and Jack sort of both did their own thing, but were both extremely successful at what they did.
Thank you so much for that question. As I referenced, our last caller was from Noblesville, and our first email question we'll get to from Bland and Greenwood is about the pride of Noblesville in Connor Daly. Now that Connor has made the field, he and his dad, Derek, become the latest father-son pair to make the 500. Who was the first? And how many fathers and sons have driven in the race?
Well, the first was Earl DeVore. I'm sorry, well, that Billy DeVore, the son of Earl DeVore, in 1937. So that's when we had the first son of a former driver. Earl DeVore was the runner-up in 27, and then Billy DeVore made his debut in 37 and had several top tens. As far as how many combinations have there been of a father and son, it's more than you'd think. And we just were working on this earlier in the week, and the answer is 24.
Wow.
And there's an asterisk there because of the fact that Larry Foyt is actually, I think is the adopted son. He is actually the grandson, and I'm probably going to get into trouble with that. But Larry Foyt is the son of a Foyt daughter,
mm-hmm.
and but he's now officially listed as the son. And it's many more than you'd think. We, you know, there's Vergevich and there's Unser. There was another early one was Thane and Norm Hauser. And then we've got Jack and Jeff Brabham. Not very many from overseas. In fact, was that the only foreign one? Now I've got myself in a jam. But anyway, we've got several now, and a total of 24.
All right. Thank you very much for that email question. We appreciate it. Let's go back to the phone lines. Bill is listening in Franklin this evening. Bill, fire away with your question for Donald Davidson.
Good evening.
How are you, sir?
I have a two-part question. Has there ever been any local driver win the 500? And my second question, who was the young lady on the network? I know her name was Katie, but she had a very articulate voice. I'll hang up and listen, but I thought she had a very articulate voice.
You
mean the lady today?
Mm-hmm.
I met her, and I don't. She looks like Sarah Fisher, but
I want to say Katie Hargis, but I don't know if that's true.
That's the name. Yes.
All right, thank you, gentlemen.
I met her this morning for the first time. Have there ever been any drivers that were born in? Yes, actually born in Indianapolis that won. There have been several Hoosiers, and the first Hoosier to win was Joe Dawson. And most of the sources list him as being born in Indianapolis. It was, in fact, Odin, but he spent most of his life in Indianapolis. And then the next one would be Howdy Wilcox, who was born in Crawfordsville and spent most of his life in Indianapolis. In fact, he and another driver named Don Herr, who was the Joe Dawson's relief driver in 1912, they formed a cab company that eventually became Yellow Cab locally. But anyway, let's see. We've got then the next one would be in 1924, LL Corum, Laura Lawrence Corum. I was told for a long time that it was Laura Lewis Corum, but it was Lawrence was the middle name. And he also is frequently listed as being born in Indianapolis. He was born down the road a piece in Jonesboro, down by like Shelbyville, Columbus area. And but he lived in Indianapolis for most of his life. Then George Souders, the 1927 winner, was from Lafayette and went to Lafayette, Jeff, and Purdue. And then Louis Schneider, the 1931 winner, was born in Indianapolis and went through the Indianapolis school system. And then Bill Cummings, the 1934 winner, was also born in Indianapolis, down on Shepherd Street, which is just a little bit south of Morris, like by maybe a block or two, Shepherd Street. And when he was a little boy, he would play in his front yard. He could hear the cars running out at the out at the track. And then Wilbur Shaw, born in Shelbyville, and spent the formative years back and forth between Shelbyville and Greensburg. But most of his life, he lived in Indianapolis. And that would be it. Wilbur Shaw was the last one. Now, for a number of years, Jim Rathman was listed as being from Valparaiso. And but as it turned out, that he was born in Los Angeles. And what happened, Jim Rathman was one of several drivers who lied about their age in order to drive in the 500. And he and Troy Ruttman were very close. They actually knew each other in school. And Ruttman is well known for having run on an altered birth certificate. Well, Jim Rathman was only 20 when he ran in the 500. But when he came to take the test in 1949, I think he made himself 24. And in order to have been born where he would have been if he was 24, his parents were actually from Valparaiso. But by the time they moved, by the time he was born, they were from Los Angeles. So he just made it Valparaiso, so it would work out right. So we finally cleared that one up. So the last Hoosier born winner was Wilbur Shaw.
So it has been a long time. And again, to clarify, because so much attention has been given to a local driver, yeah. Ed Carpenter, again, grew up around the Speedway, Park Tudor School for high school, Butler for his collegiate education, but technically from Paris, Illinois, is the hometown of Ed Carpenter. Plenty of great email questions pouring in, plenty of good ones on the telephone lines as well. We're back with more of those in the moment. You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.
The Talk of Gasoline Alley is brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice.
Greg Rakestraw and Donald Davidson with you. It is the Talk of Gasoline Alley here on 107.5 FM and 1070 The Fan. Your questions of an historic or nostalgic nature about the Indianapolis 500 and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. A series of questions from Robert listening in Lancaster, California, and one from couple of Formula One drivers in the 50s that intrigued me, so here we go. Please profile Alberto Ascari and Juan Fangio regarding their visit to the Speedway during the 1950s. Were there any other European drivers that attempted to drive at the Speedway during the 40s and 50s?
Oh, yes. Luigi Villoresi actually qualified in 46 and finished 7th. Those who had a Formula One start, I'm not going to get them all because there's more than you would think, but Ascari and Fangio are the two, and they were world champions, but when Ascari came, he wasn't the world champion yet. He was going to be, and then I'll further confuse it by saying that when Ascari won it in 52 and 53, the world championship of drivers was a brand new thing. 50 was the first one. They didn't use Formula One. They used Formula Two. But anyway, Ascari was the only one to qualify. Fangio did not. And that could be a whole segment just telling about the visit. Dr. Giuseppe Farina, who was a 1950 world champion, was the other who came here. Actually, he was entered in 50, 56, and 57. He didn't come the first year, but he was here in both 56 and 57 and didn't make it. Ascari came with, there were several Ferraris that were bought here, and there were actually five were entered, four showed up. he had what they called the works car, the factory car. The other three were sold to Americans, and it ended up being the only one that qualified. It was a 4.5-liter unsupercharged V12, and there's a myth about the fact that he changed gears in the turn so smoothly that you couldn't hear the gear change. Well, that's baloney. What happened was he tried gearing down and gearing up, but realized it didn't make any difference. So when he qualified, he wasn't doing that. But he only ran 40 laps and he finished 31st, but he was just about to enter the first 10 when a wire wheel collapsed, and they had struggled quite a bit during practice with the car. And one of the things that the Americans had tried was mag wheels, because they were on wires. Not all the way around, but they did try like mags on the rear and different combinations. But and some people suggested to us, Gary, that he might want to try mags, but they stayed with the wire wheels, and it was a wire wheel that collapsed and he spun out. But anyway, Ascari apparently spoke no English. But he was a charming man and just a lovely bloke, as the Brits would say, and supposedly spoke no English. But one day, a very brash young American driver was sitting on the wall with some others when Ascari came in after another practice session, took off the helmet, took off the gloves, wiped his brow, looked just a little bit bewildered. And this young driver, who would go on to win the 500 more than once, said, well, to nobody in particular, well, Alberto, I guess you're just going to have to stand on it a little harder. And the others laughed, whereupon Ascari reached into the cockpit, pulled the helmet out and the gloves, and came over and presented them to the driver that just made the comment. But anyway, the Fangio situation was... Fangio had actually come to the Speedway in 1948 before anybody knew who he was. He was on his way to Europe with some sportsmen, and there's a photograph of the group from Argentina, and if you look in there, one of the group is Fangio. So anyway, he goes to Europe, and then in 49 is when he first sort of starts to become well known, and then he wins the world championship five times. And then as the five-time world champion, came here in 58 when he was right at the end of his career, and he drove for the Walthers. He drove the Dayton Steel Foundry Special. It was a Curtis Craft. It was an Offie, but it wasn't the best. But he had, the rumors were every year, if you read the English magazines, there was a rumor that he was going to drive a V16 BRM, and he was going to drive this, that, and the next thing. Sonny Meyer, who's going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame on Thursday night, said that he remembers when Fangio came to Meyer and Drake. Louis Meyer and Dale Drake had the Offey engine business. And I know this is more of an answer than you wanted, but in the shop at that time, being fitted for an engine, was a sort of a house experimental car, which ended up being the Jones and Maley Special, which was the car that was on the roof at Southeastern for all those years. Well, when that was a brand new car, that was going to have a supercharged Offey, and it was at the shop in about, probably, I'm guessing it was March of 54, that Fangio probably was in the country to drive at the Sebring 12 hours. And so he went to Meyer and Drake and was fascinated by this car and wanted to drive it. But Sonny said that Fangio was so gracious. He didn't speak English and would have an interpreter with him, but he was a very gracious man, and said that he was so amazed at the how open everything was, and it wasn't that way in Europe. And he said that they let him go back into the engine room. And he said, I drove for Alfa Romeo for 2 years and was the number one Grand Prix driver, and they wouldn't let me back in the in the engine room. And then I remember that Sonny said also the other thing, because that Fangio, where he was born, and I don't know how this is pronounced, but it's like Balcarce or something like that, B-A-L-C-E, I don't know. Anyway, wherever he was from, his garage had a dirt floor. And after he'd won the world championship several times, friends said, well, why don't you concrete the floor. And he said, because I don't want to forget where I came from. And so anyway, Sonny said that the thing that impressed Fangio the most was not only were there mechanics and people coming in from the other shops and borrowing the tools, but there were two lathes. And between the two lathes, there was a saucer for the cat to drink milk out of. And he was so impressed on that. But anyway, I didn't cover all of the Europeans that came during those years. But, you know, Fangio and Ascari and Farina were just, I mean, those were the three biggies in Grand Prix racing. And if you look at the Indianapolis results, it doesn't tell the story.
Robert, thank you so much for the email, and thank you for listening to us all the way out in California. Let's go closer to home and closer in recent history as well. Mark is in Brownsburg, and he is on with Donald Davidson via 239-1070. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Hello, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. My question has to do, or my comment has to do with early exits of the Indy 500. And I remember, if I am correct, is in 2005, Carmelo Anthony, who we just sent packing by our NBA Pacer basketball players back to New York, he, Carmelo Anthony, I believe had two cars in the show. PJ Chesson was one of his drivers, and I don't remember the name of the other teammate. And PJ Chesson, on lap one, in turn two, took out his only teammate, and Carmelo's cars were both gone from the race. So I know that was an early exit, and I'm sure you know of others.
I do. Actually, the cars were owned by Ron Hemelgarn. He was the entrant. And Carmelo Anthony was one of several sponsors. The other driver was Jeff Bucknum, who was the son of Ronnie Bucknum. And that's another father-son combination that drove in the 500. Uh-huh. But, yeah, poor Ron Hemelgarn. The thing had barely started. Then his two drivers had crashed into each other and finished 32nd and 33rd. And yeah. We did do a thing earlier about a fellow named Carlos Guerrero, who was 33rd and zero laps in his only 500. And that I think there's probably, I could do him, but it would just take a little while to figure out everybody that drove in the, had one 500 start and finished last in their only start. And P.J. Chesson was one of them, not the most recent, but he was one of the drivers on that list.
Hey, Mark, thanks for your phone call. We appreciate it. We had a reference to Buddy Lazier from an earlier telephone caller as far as former starters that have began a race on the last row, former winners, I may sure mm-hmm. I should say it, and actually one of our listeners has emailed in. Yes. He thinks he's got the research on it, so this okay. is what Matt has to say.
Well, anybody can look it up.
Right, okay. I know, but and Donald, I vouch, as no, always, no right. notes, nothing in front of him. Doesn't even know what the question's about until you ask it. Here okay. we go. Matt says, Buddy Lazier started in the middle of the last row in 2008.
Okay.
Fred Frame, inside of the last row in 36.
Okay.
Gordon Johncock, 91 and 92.
Yes, he was 33rd in 91.
Graham Hill, 67.
Yeah.
Mario in 78. And Troy Ruttman in 63.
Oh, okay. Ruttman's was a qualifying. I mean, all of those, I think of every one of those was a qualifying situation where you actually, that's the position they earned. Mario in 78 was a driver switch because he was going to the first qualifying weekend in 78 was rained out. And so on the second weekend was the Belgian Grand Prix of Spa-Francorchamps, and an arrangement was made that Mike Hiss would qualify the car, and that that Mario would go to the back. And there was another year, 1981, he also started in the last row. But Troy Ruttman actually qualified. That was a wing and a prayer. He actually qualified for 33rd position in 63 with the Jim Robbins Autocrat seatbelt special.
Hey, Matt, thank you for that email. We appreciate that. We'll take more of your telephone calls, more of your emails when we come back. We are with you until 8 o'clock this evening from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, where practice and qualification activity wrapped up about 45 minutes ago. You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.
The Talk of Gasoline Alley is brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice.
Back at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Greg Rakestraw, our privilege to be hanging out with Donald Davidson between now and 8 o'clock here on 107.5 FM and 1070 The Fan. Your telephone calls at 239-1070. Got some great emails as well. You can send those my way, greg@1070thefan.com. And oftentimes we have somebody that emails in, I want you to talk about insert name here. This listener who is emailing me, Alex, actually is referencing a picture and wants to know who is the person in the picture.
Okay.
Here is his email. I saw a picture of a man standing in front of an old wooden shed that has a lot of different logos on it. The caption said it was the oil shed at the Speedway. Who was that man?
Oh, it's probably Ed Wintergust. That's just a guess. Who had the nickname of the Earl, the mayor of Gasoline Alley. And the term Gasoline Alley is now encompasses the entire garage area, but when it was first used, it was the corner where the fuel depot was. And Earl Wintergust worked for, I think, was it Richfield Oil or something like that? And he was just sort of like their rep at the track, but, just a character. And the nickname, the mayor of Gasoline Alley. So I'm assuming that's who that is. If he's tall, then it would be him. Ed Wintergust was very tall.
Alex, thank you for that email. We appreciate it. Back to the phone lines we go. Greg is dialing us up from Knightstown this evening. Greg, good evening and welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Fine, Greg. Thank you.
Great. Couple things I wanted to see. If my memory served me right, my 12-year-old and I were talking. He was asking me. We were out at the Napoli yesterday and asking me how many drivers had been killed during the 500. And then, so I wanted to ask you that, had lost their lives, and also just how many, if you know, you may not know, but just at Indianapolis Motor Speedway throughout the years, how many fatalities. And the last one, I believe, was it a Hawaiian driver in practice, maybe 10 or 15 years ago that lost his life?
It was Jovi Marcelo from the Philippines. All right, I'll tell you what I'll do. Was it Manila? Anyway, I'll tell you what I do. Whenever I get that question, I turn it around, and I'll ask you a question. I'll ask you a two-parter, and you might be surprised by both answers. When would you say, and I'm just talking about the race only, when was the last time that a driver sustained injuries in a race and passed away later? That's part one. And then part two was, when was the last time that a driver actually lost their life on race day?
Would it be Sweet Savage on race day?
It would indeed, yes, which was 1973.
Okay.
And then the last time that there was a fatality on race day with a driver was the Eddie Sachs, Dave McDonald double fatality in 1964. And I think that is absolutely astonishing, because I think the public perception is that there's fatalities in the 500 every year or every other year. And 1973 was the last time. But the answer to your question is the total that lost their life in the race was 14.
Okay.
And then in practice and qualifying, it's many more than that.
Yeah,
sure.
And the majority of those were compressed into the early years, and then the 30s, and there was a bad period in the 50s and early 60s. And then there's several different categories, because you have not only practice and qualifications, and I'll come back with another one that will really surprise you. And then, of course, you've got the private testing as well. So I have a number, but it's alarmingly high, or maybe not. I don't know. But let me come back and give you this other one, which is a real surprise.
Okay.
And it is, when is, and I don't expect you to know it, but I'll throw it out and play the game anyway. When was the last time that a driver lost their life on a qualification attempt? And I'm going to clarify that by saying you had to have taken the flag. Now, there are a couple, and if you're going to say Gordon Smiley.
Yeah, he was
Gordon
getting
ready Smiley,
to green, right?
Yes, he was on a qualifying. He had gone out to make a qualifying attempt, but he was still doing the practice lap and had not taken the green. When is the last time that somebody actually was fatally injured while on a qualifying run?
Boy, I sure don't know, but I would guess the 50s.
You got to go back further than that. It was W.H. Stubby Stubblefield in 1935.
Wow.
And that is astonishing, because you would think that that's when you're laying it on the line is
sure.
qualifying. And whether you're going to the pole or on the last day and just desperately trying to make the race, that's when you would think that you were extended to the most, and that would be the time when you would have a fatal accident. 1935 is the last
that's
one.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Sure.
Hey, Greg, thanks for the telephone call, buddy.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. By the way, Alex emailed me back. Thanks for the answer. Yes, he was a tall guy, and there is a sign over the door that says mayor.
Okay. Ed Windergrass. Thank you.
Let's go to another email, and this is from Toby. He asks if you could profile Jerry Sneva, and Toby says, I've always admired him for his ability to get the most out of outdated equipment. He was kind of like Bob Harkey in that way.
Absolutely. All right, how long have I got?
We got 5 or 6 minutes.
Oh, all right. Well, and then we're doing another hour. So
absolutely.
All right. Well, Jerry Sneva, the best finish that he had was 10th in 1977, and he won Rookie of the Year. It was a real surprise that going in, you had to think that looking at the equipment that Danny Ongais was going to be Rookie of the Year. And Jerry Sneva was great with the press and got a 10th place and won Rookie of the Year. But he did some amazing qualifying attempts, and I think we've documented these not only before, but even even this year. But I'll do it again, because we're sort of kind of at a different time and maybe a different audience. Probably the best one was 1979, and he was driving for Bruce Crower with a stock block Chevy, and they were having difficulties. In fact, I think they were just about done at the point where this happened. There was the Warner Hodgson team. They had Roger McCluskey and a Carsworth, but they also had an AMC, a turbocharged AMC, that Neil Bonnet had taken his rookie test in.
Okay.
And so, you know, Bonnet obviously was going to go ahead and qualify the car, because at that point, he didn't have a regular NASCAR ride. Something happened, and I don't remember what the circumstances were, but the Wood Brothers car became available. And so he went over there to sort of be the temporary driver, over there being Dover. And he was going to qualify at Dover on the Friday, and then come back to the Speedway and then try to qualify Saturday in 79, and then go back and run the race on Sunday. Well, in the meantime, there was a rain delay in Dover. And so he thought he should stay there, because the Wood Brothers, that was quite an opportunity. So in the meantime, his car is sitting here. And so the crew went to Jerry Sneva and said, look, we need somebody to kind of get this thing running. And if Neil Bonnet shows up, then it'll be his ride. So Jerry did a thing very similar to what we said earlier with George Snyder, whereby he thought, I can get some practice time by going through, join the qualifying line, which is long. I can go out. I can take 3 laps. And which you could do in those days, and then I'll get the feel for the car, we'll come back, and then we'll make some changes, and then do 3 more, and we can keep doing that if the track doesn't open for practice. And so anyway, he went through the first time and didn't take the flag. They made some changes, came through the line again, and this time he took the green. And at some point during the run, the throttle stuck. Now, you would bring it in, except you've got this opportunity to qualify this thing for the Indianapolis 500. I find this extraordinary. He drove either the entire run or most of the run with the kill switch by just flipping the switch off and on for the turns. Yes, I'm not kidding you.
Wow.
And when he came in, he qualified, and they proved that the throttle had stuck. Anyway, he qualified for the race. Neil Bonnet stayed in Dover, won the Dover race, as somebody pointed out to me, and so that became a regular ride. And unfortunately, Jerry, he was out early, finished 31st, but that was just a phenomenal thing. In 1980, he qualified for the middle of the second row, and started fifth for Sherman Armstrong with a pickup crew with a bunch of friends. Nobody was on the payroll. Everybody volunteered their time. In fact, I think his dad was the chassis man. Sherman Armstrong had four cars or five cars and basically said, look, you know, we don't have a crew to run it. Here, the car's yours. You do it. And they qualified fifth. And then had an accident on robbing of what would have been a top 10 finish. And then in 1982 was another one where he's driving for the Hoffman family of Cincinnati. And he had an engine problem coming down for the checker. And he had the forethought to jump it out of gear and freewheel across the line, and was fast enough to make it. There was a couple of others, too, where he didn't make it. But it was Jerry Sneva, compared with Tom, was rather like the Roger Mears with Rick.
Right.
Roger Mears deserved a lot better record at the Indianapolis Speedway than he got. And the same, you know, Jerry, it would have been nice to see him get some better shakes. But he hangs around and he lives here and does all the autograph parties and everything. In fact, he will be signing autographs on Saturday afternoon. Maybe one of these nights we'll try to give you a rundown on some of the people that are going to be there signing autographs.
Sounds great. Thank you for that email question, folks. Keep them coming. Greg at 1070thefan.com. Not to mention the telephone lines, which are open but are currently full at 239-1070. We'll get to some of those telephone questions when we come back. We are here until 8 o'clock. You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 FM and 1070 The Fan. One more hour yet to go of our day-long coverage of Bump Day at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Again, 9 qualifiers were set today. It is Michelle Jourdain Jr. who will not be making the 97th running of the Indianapolis 500. Earlier this afternoon, Joseph Newgarden, Graham Rahal, Sebastian Saavedra, Tristan Vaudier, Anna Beatrice, Pippa Mann, Connor Daly, Buddy Lazier, and Catherine Legg all confirmed their spots in next Sunday's running of the race. We take your telephone calls at 239-1070 or your emails, Greg at 1070thefan.com, for the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in Donald Davidson. We've been spending some time talking about the state of Illinois because, again, while we claim Ed Carpenter as a Hoosier, his birthplace is Paris, Illinois. For this telephone call, we go to Vernon Hills, Illinois, where Mike has been standing by. Mike, good evening. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Mike.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. Donald, I wonder if you could talk about Bud Tinglestad tonight.
Oh, I'd love to. the way I chuckled there, I was talking with Greg earlier about the setup here, and I said that I would prefer to not know what the subject is, and it did. So when you asked me that, I mean, that comes out cold. I don't know who's on the phone or what the question's going to be. Yeah, Bud Tinglestad was somebody I really got to know very well, and just review the career at the Speedway. He was from Ohio. Actually, he was born in Minnesota, Frisee, Minnesota. But his Speedway career was 1960 through he was at the Speedway from 1960 to 1972. He was not in the race every year, but virtually every year. He was not in it in 61. I'm doing this the hard way. And I better go back through the years. All right, 60 was the first start, and he was entered for the McKay Special, passed his test, and then ended up driving one of the Jim Robbins specials and finished ninth. And then in 61, he did not make the show, but he made qualifying attempts with the Dean Van Line special and the Bardo special. In 62, he drove the Constant Hot special and was 15th, and that was Bruce Hohmeyer with Judd Phillips as a mechanic. In 63, he came with a stock block Chevy, which has one of my favorite car names, the Auto Power Maniomatic Special, which ended up, he got out of that and then drove the Hoover special to finish 29th. I haven't done it year by year on one of the, I began recently, just doing the highlights. But anyway, in 64, it was the Federal Engineering Detroit Special, and he finished sixth, and that was his best finish. And then in 65, he drove the American Red Ball Special, which was a Lola, and I would say that was probably his best run. Again, I say the final results don't tell the story. He was 16th, and I think did 115 laps, but he ran third for a while, and came up through the pack to do it. And Lotus was sort of the hot setup there. There were a couple of Lolas. Parnelli Jones had one, and there was one other. But anyway, Lindsay Hopkins was who Tinkelstad was driving for. And so he talked about working with the engineers. And the funny thing was that Eric Broadley was the principal of Lola, and Bud thought his name was Bradley, but that's okay. rather than do all of these 15ths and 21st and so on and so forth, one shot that looked like it was going to be great that unfortunately was a bit of a disappointment was when Al Unser in 1969 was driving for Vell and Parnelli, and there was a four-wheel drive car and a rear drive, and Bud was having a bit of a struggle with both. I'm sorry, not Bud, but Al Unser was having a bit of a struggle with both, and the first qualifying weekend was virtually completely wiped out. And on the night of the first qualifying day, we got word that he had had an accident on a motorcycle jumping the ditches on the infield, which you can't do now, but you could then, and he'd broken his leg. And so Al had to sit out the 1969 500 with a broken leg. And so then the big thing was, well, who's going to drive the car? Bignotti was the mechanic. And so the rumor was Jackie Stewart. The rumor was going to be George Fulmer, I remember, was in the running. And Parnelli actually offered the ride to Jim Hurtubise, his old friend. And Hurtubise turned it down. So it ended up it was Tinkelstad was the driver. And he drove the rear drive and was running about seventh and then had an engine problem. And that was too bad because you thought, well, that's going to be Bud's best shot. In 1971, he was Vukovic's teammate on the Sugar Right Prune specials, and Judd Phillips was the chief mechanic on the Vukovic car, and Tom Smith was the chief mechanic on the Tinkelstad car, and Bud finished seventh. In fact, there's a little story that I don't know if I should tell, and maybe I won't, but it's about a private bet that Jerry O'Connell had with his mother involving quite a bit of money, and Tinkelstad figured into that one. But, we may do that one on another time. But Tinkelstad had some excellent runs in championship races and in sprint cars. There were times when he just drove like a man possessed. And one of the great moment at DuQuoin on Labor Day of 1966 when Tinkelstad won the DuQuoin 100. But he also had some seconds and thirds. Langhorne he did very well at. There was a race at Trenton when he showed up and didn't even have a ride and hooked up with the Federal Engineering people and finished second. I really liked Bud. He had some health issues and passed away. And when I mentioned Tom Smith, his wife, Bud's widow, Arlene, who used to, at one time she was a waitress at a Howard Johnson's out here, she married Tom Smith, and then he passed away not too long ago. But anyway, Bud was somebody I really liked. He was from the Dayton, Ohio area for most of his career. Great sprint car driver and just a great little character.
Hey, Mike, thank you so much for the phone call. We greatly appreciate it. Have an email question, and since there was an Al Unser reference and there was even a mother reference, this bleeds perfectly into this email question from Joe. Please talk about the mother of Al and Bobby Unser.
Okay, Mom Unser.
I know she was well-known at the track, and I remember, she made chili the morning of each 500.
Well, not necessarily the morning of each 500, but no, she was a real character, Mary Unser, and she raised all them boys out in Albuquerque. And I remember that that when she would come around, and she was such a character, she sort of became involved in like the victory banquet and some of the appearances that they did. And I thought she had an amazing stage presence, and I thought that she might have been a performer. And not necessarily, but there was a side to her that a lot of people didn't know. And I remember that Tom Carnegie said to me one time, you know, he really came to like the Yonchers a lot. And he said, I didn't really know anything about them. And he said, you know, Bobby Unser had won the 500 in 1968, and this was, you know, when he was Channel 6 sports director. And he thought, well, you know, we'll go out there and do a feature. We'll go out to Albuquerque. I didn't know New Mexico, and I'm out at Albuquerque. And he said, I fell in love with the place. But he said, we went to the house, and he said the mother was there. You know, she. I don't know if Craggy is fair, but I mean, the weather. She you know, she had the wrinkles, but the darks, the very brown skin from just being out in the desert all the time, and so he said. I went into the house and waiting for Bobby or Al, and she was there. And he said, there was a piano there. And he said, I learned a lesson. I hope this is coming over the right way. He said, I learned a lesson that you never judge people or pigeonhole them. And he said, so I'm sitting there, there's a piano, and there's a, you know, Carnegie with the voice, who plays that? And she says, well, I do. He said, you do? He said, I looked at her. I didn't think she could play the piano. And he said, oh, well, you know, play me something. And she sat down and started playing a piece of classical music because she was classically trained. And she was famous for that chili. And it was quite a concoction. And they used to put tequila in it, or at least that was the rumor. And so they did a lot of charity things. And I remember that I'm not big on Mexican food or anything that's really hot or spicy. I did sample that chili, and boy, it didn't taste like I thought it was going to. So not for me, but some people would, you know, they would love it. There was a great picture that we used in the program one time. I think it must have been a story about the Unsers, but I know we had this photo, and it's the old garage area parking lot with the gravel. And she was doing had the food line going, and I remember that the there was a canister of something that you would spray into. It's like an aerosol can, okay. Except that it was something that you would spray. It was part of the mixture,
okay.
And it must have been like a hot sauce thing. But anyway, the plastic cap was a fireman with a helmet on it.
Which is not a good sign if you don't like spicy food.
No. And so there's this photograph with about three of these and the bowl of chili. And there's Roger Ward with this look on his face as if to say, I don't know if I want to try this stuff or not. But anyway, she was a great character. Mom Unser and Al and Bobby and the dad as well, Jerry Unser Sr. And if you see the photographs, you know, Bobby really favors his dad.
Right.
So I don't know if that's a reasonable way to wrap it up, but she was a very, very nice lady indeed.
Thanks for your email question, Joe. We appreciate that. More of your phone calls. In fact, we've got one line available right now at 239-1070. More of your email questions as well when we come back. Alongside Donald Davidson, Greg Rakestraw with you, it is the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and you are listening on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.
The Talk of Gasoline Alley is brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry, skilled on principle, union by choice.
Perhaps you are listening in the shadows here at 16th and Georgetown of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Maybe you're listening in Lanesville, Indiana. Or maybe you are listening in North Yorkshire in the United Kingdom, which is where Tom is listening tonight. Because it is later in the evening. In fact, it's early morning over in the UK as we speak, and Tom sends us this email. He says hello to both of us, and he says, I was watching some 1911-1912 newsreels on YouTube from the Indianapolis 500 last week, and it mentioned using a red flag and a caption to signal the start of the race. Mm-hmm. When did Indianapolis change from the red flag to the more conventional green flag that you see today to signal the start? Thanks, and many thanks for the show.
1930.
Okay.
What he was watching on YouTube, I think I know what that would be. It's not 1912. There's no 1912 footage that I know of. It's all 1911 rather.
Okay.
Fortunately, there was enough preserved. I think there's probably about 12, 13, 14 minutes of 1911 footage. But yeah, the red flag was what started the race. All the way up through 1929, and that's why when one is making a statement or trying to do a trivia question or whatever, there's all kinds of traps. And one of the things is how many drivers have driven in the Indianapolis 500, or how many drivers have started in the Indianapolis 500. Some people modify that. How many have taken the green flag in the
right.
Indianapolis 500? Well, then you need to subtract everybody that ran in 29 and earlier, because they started with a red flag. But 1930 is the answer.
All right, Tom, thank you for the email, and thanks for listening across the pond. We appreciate it. And that leads into Paul in Indianapolis' question on the telephone lines at 239-1070. Good evening, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Fine, thank you. What would you like to hear about?
I would like you, Donald, to talk about the history of the flagmen for the Indianapolis 500. And then if you could specifically focus in on Sedan and the gentleman from my Dwayne Sweeney.
Unfortunately, you were cutting out the end of your telephone call there, Paul. We appreciate you dialing us up. Flagman at the Motor Speedway.
It's about the
though.
Flagman at the Indianapolis mm-hmm. Motor Speedway. And even with that cutting in and out, I think he was talking, he may have been talking about the rope bridge that they used to walk out on, or maybe not. The famous ones, of course, were Seth Klein, who flagged, I think, from 1925 to 53. But occasionally they would name another flagman. And this is a little bit tricky, because the difference between somebody that was like a celebrity flagman and did they just sort of wave the start and then go in the stands and then somebody else did the work the rest
sure.
of the day. But there were other years, like, for instance, Grantland Rice, who was a famous author and sports writer, was the flagman one year. And then Colonel Roscoe Turner, who... was a famed aviator that lived his final years in Indianapolis. He was the flagman one year. But the first one was Pop Wagner. Fred Pop Wagner did 1911 and 1912, and then he didn't come back after that because he and Carl Fisher had a dispute. But Seth Klein was probably the first one that did it on a regular basis. And then from 54 to 61, it was Bill Vandewater, who was from Chicago. And then he actually had surgery and then passed away. And then the assistant starter one of the assistant starters had been Pat Fedan. And it was Pat flagged from 62 to 79. And then it was Dwayne Sweeney from 80 through to, and now the recent years run together for me. And then Brian Howard was the starter, and then Paul Blevins. And then I think that they have alternated for a few years, and I'm never quite clear how that worked out. So, but those are the two that have done it in the recent years. And then, of course, they've had the celebrity flagmen like, Jack Nicholson and a few others. And honestly, to me, it's the guy that does all the work that I would consider the starter or the flagman. I think that was Paul from Racine, except he happened to be in Indianapolis, and maybe I'm wrong with that. But what I thought I heard him say something about out, and I thought, I wonder if he meant the rope bridge that went across from 14, I think, is about the earliest I can think of that being there. And it went till like maybe 1924. But I'm only guessing that that's what the question was. So maybe we should get somebody else a shot.
Well, I tell you what, yeah. I'll actually kind of ask a follow-up to that.
Okay.
When you see older footage, you see things being flagged on the track.
Oh, yeah.
When did that change to the flag stand that we have today?
Well, in a Pat loved to flag from the ground, and so did Bill Vandewater. And to directly answer the question, I can't directly answer a question. There was a time when there was a flag stand on the outside up high, And they, in fact, sometimes you'll see where there's two checkered flags. There'll be one up high and then another one down on the ground. But anyway, when did the chief flagman move to the up to the other side and up? That was 1974. And it's when Tom Binford came in as chief steward to replace Harlan Fengler. And one of the things that he asked for was, instead of being down at track level, Harlan Fengler liked to stand on the grass verge by the pit wall in the pit lane. And there were several times, we actually talked about this the other night, but there were several episodes where there were participants would run across to have discussion, and Tom Binford thought, I don't think I want to be that accessible. And so he asked for a judge's stand to be built on the outside, right next to the start finish line, up, and I don't know what the height would be, but it's approximately the height that the one is that is there. And so part of the requirement was that the flagman go to the other side and up high. And Pat loved to do the twirling routine and sort of a skip and end up on one knee and as you do the final twirl. And by being on the outside and up in this restricted area, he couldn't do that
right
anymore. He wasn't too happy about it. He did the best he could.
Hey, thank you so much for that email question, for that telephone question, I should say, and earlier in our coverage in between the qualifying shows in the first hour and happy hour today, Michael Young was up in the flag stand and talked to Paul Blevins, again, one of the guys that does it currently. Let's go back to the phone lines. Don in Plainfield kind of has a reversal of a question that was asked in the first hour of the show. Don, how you doing?
Pretty good, Donald. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
I've been an IndyCar fan for just about as long as I live. We've always lived out here in Plainfield. But I've also been a Formula One fan for almost ever since they started, and that would be around the middle 50s. And that was through magazines. I would almost swear, I'm getting old now, I'd almost swear that there was a time when either one or two or three Indy cars went to the new High Bank Monza track at that time. Is that
is
correct?
Yes, 1957 and 1958.
Okay.
They ran a 500-mile race was held in 57 and 58, but it was run in three legs because Firestone had determined that it was a high-bank concrete oval. It was very rough, and the speeds were faster than Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And so the event came about because Monza went back to the 20s, but the oval, the high-banked oval, went in 1955, and it hooked in with the road course. And it was pretty intricate because they ran the Italian Grand Prix in 55 and 56 with the oval hooked in with the road course. And so you would do a lap on the road course and then a lap on the oval. And I can't really describe how they would move from one lane to the other, but it was really neat the way it worked out. But it also presented a scoring situation because you'd come by the start finish line twice per lap. Well, anyway, that said, the reason that the oval went in was that it could also be run as a separate course because they thought that they could probably derive some income by having factories come there to break records. And anyway, the head of, I think it was the Milan Auto Club, but very strongly connected with Monza, and I'm not making this up, Giuseppe Bacci. His name. I'm not making that up. And he liked Indianapolis. And so his dream was that the cars would come over. So the event that they envisioned was that it would be the 10 top Indianapolis 500 drivers and cars would run against the top 10 Europeans.
Wow.
And unfortunately, the Europeans didn't take too kindly to the event, and they pretty much abandoned it. In fact, they formed a group. It was a union. It was the UPPI, and it was like Union Professionisti Politi Internationale or something like that. I don't speak Italian. But anyway, so it ended up that Jimmy Bryan went with the Dean Van Line special. Troy Ruttman for Zinc. Johnny Parsons for Agajanian. There were a number of Americans that didn't want to go. I mean, the owners just as much as the drivers, so they kind of had to have a bit of a pickup there. But the two Novis went with Paul Russo Tony Bettenhausen.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Okay. Well,
They were fast.
Paul Russo had a mechanical problem in practice, and they didn't take any spares, so if they broke anything, they were done. But Tony Bettenhausen, and this doesn't sound like anything now with the speeds that we saw today, but Tony Bettenhausen in the V8 supercharged Novi did a lap at 177 miles an hour. 177 miles an hour on those narrow tires. Well, I mean, that Indianapolis at the time was like 145. And those were phenomenal speeds. In fact, Dennis Jenkinson, a British journalist, and he's the man who rode with Sterling Moss and Amelia Miller in 55, he said that that was one of the most exciting moments that he'd ever experienced in motor racing was Bettenhausen with the Novi just wide open. Anyway, the Europeans pretty much abandoned the thing, and he really got on them. And there was a Frenchman named Jean Bérard that didn't want anything to do with the union, but he practiced but ended up not running. And the final for the Europeans was three D-type Jaguar sports cars. So it was supposed to be open wheel cars, but these three Jaguar sports cars went. And they went directly from the 24 hours of Le Mans. They finished first and second at Le Mans and then went to Monza. They trucked them to Monza, and they were there like on Tuesday for Thursday practice. But Firestone had sent their tire test car over with Pat O'Connor and determined that that tire wear would be a serious problem, and so they ran the race in three legs. And so Jimmy Bryan won the first two, and then Troy Ruttman won the final, but Brian was the winner overall with Ruttman second. But Sachs went, Pat O'Connor went, and Bob Veith. Anyway, the next year was the Europeans gave it a little more support, and this time Jim Rathman won all three legs to win the thing overall. And Jimmy Bryan was second with the George Sally laydown. And the real surprise was Luigi Musso in a Ferrari. And I could go on forever with this thing, but again, it shows you how times have changed and the whole thinking. Luigi Musso, with a top-heavy single-seat Ferrari, won the pole, beat all of the Americans, and that astonished everyone. And I think he had like a 3-liter sports car engine. It might have been a larger engine than that. But anyway, the thing is that Phil Hill said that engine came out of the car that the Marquis de Portago had a dreadful accident in the closing stages of the Mille Miglia. And they had this engine out of this wrecked sports car. But in those days, you need an engine. Let's put this one in it. And so anyway, that car finished third overall. And Luigi Musso drove most of the race, but he overcame by fumes. And then Mike Hawthorn drove a few laps, and Phil Hill drove a few laps. But Foyt went, and because he was going to drive the Dean Van Lines car, but the Italian organizer said, well, you know, we don't know who this A.J. Foyt is, and they put Fangio in the car. Foyt went and relieved, and this is one of my favorite. The Americans took some roadsters for the Europeans. One of my favorite assignments, Maurice Trintignant, in the Sclavian Amar special with A.J. Foyt as a co-driver. But anyway, I could run down a bunch of other people that went. It was really near Ray Crawford. But in 1959, the event was not held again. The final thing I'll say on this, and it's hard to stop because I really have a great passion for those events. What was astonishing was the fact that the cars that went that were so beautifully prepared, and it was an eye opener for the European journalists because of the fact that there was so much secretive. As I mentioned with the Fangio story earlier, everybody was sort of so protective in Europe. the Americans were very open. And people like Dennis Jenkins had said that the cars were so beautifully kept, and they were constantly polishing the cars, and the lettering and the pinstriping and everything, and the fact that the driver's name was neatly written on the side, and the owner, and then also the crew, and that the fact that the crew were so proud of the cars, and if you went up and showed interest in the car, they'd lift up the hood and show you the engine. Well, the Europeans didn't do that.
So anyway,
I think, and they love Jimmy Bryan because, he's walking around with the sunglasses and the swagger and everything. And I think it gave them a whole new appreciation for the American drivers.
Don, thank you so much for the phone call. We appreciate
it. Thank you very much for the answer.
Thank you.
Folks, keep those telephone calls coming at 239-1070. Your emails as well, greg@1070thefan.com. We are with you for just shy of a half an hour. It is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.
The Talk of Gasoline Alley is brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice.
Greg Rakestraw, Donald Davidson with you here on 107.5 FM and 1070 The Fan. With you until the top of the hour at 8 o'clock. 239-1070 is the telephone number. Phone lines are full right now. I want to get to an email from Brett, who emailed us at the beginning of the show, and I'm going to add a phrase in the middle of his question because that would be my guess. I could be wrong. How often or has it ever been the case that every starter has finished the race?
No, that's never happened.
Okay.
That's easy.
Can tell the part that I added, by the way.
Yeah.
So, Brett, with that question. So let's go to a different question. This is from Mayo, who is calling in from Southern Indiana about a difference at the beginning of the race. Thanks for your phone call. Fire away with Donald.
Hello.
Hey, Donald. Mayo here. How are you?
Mayo. Hi. John Hollinsworth Mayo?
John Hollinsworth Mayo. You got it,
okay.
By the way, what nice comments you made about Jerry Sneve a while ago. What a nice
thank you.
Person he is.
Yeah.
And while you're talking, and this isn't what I called about, but you were talking about the overseas race, John went to the Mount Fuji race. You might talk about that sometime if you remember. Okay, what I wanted to find out from you, have we ever had a race with no alternate starters? Do we have a race with no alternate starters this year? And if so, why would Bobby Rahal not have gone ahead and, even if they only qualified at 10 miles an hour, at least become an alternate?
Yeah, I would have asked that question a few years ago, but I can give you the reason why they wouldn't. They don't nominate alternates now. They used to. Has there ever been a year when there were none? Yes, because there were years when there were short fields.
Mm-hmm.
But it used to be that they would name a first alternate and a second alternate, and then there were different interpretations as to whether they would be eligible to start or not. And for instance, in 1941, there was Sam Hanks crashed the day before the race in the carburation runs. He'd actually had a crankshaft break and he crashed. And then on the morning of the race, there was a fire, and a good section of the garage area burned down, and they lost a car that George Barringer had qualified. And so there were two other people that had qualified and got bumped, or qualified and were not slow enough, that wanted to come into the field. And they were prevented from doing so because of an incident that happened in 1937 involving Joel Thorne, in which he effectively tried to buy his way in. And that's kind of a lengthy story, but the short of it is that Joel Thorne was the second alternate starter, very wealthy young man that drove in the race four times, but he hadn't yet. And so as the second alternate, he purchased the car that was the first alternate and withdrew it to make himself the first alternate. And then the thinking was that he would purchase another one. And then when he was told that he couldn't do that, he made an arrangement, actually, with a man named George Lyons, who Cliff Brazier had qualified for. And he made an arrangement with them, and he was going to buy the car and then withdraw it so he could come in. Well, the officials got the wind of it, and they went down and told him he couldn't do it. And he said, well, supposing I buy the whole field and withdraw them all. And so he went out the door and proceeded to make it. But Joel Thorne was a millionaire who never had any money, And so he went out, and then the officials had discussion. Thought we, you know, we better go around the garage area and you know, tell them if Thorn comes around, don't make a deal with him. And only to find out that they were a little late on some of them. But anyway, they went and they called him back in and said, look, you can't do that. And what, you know, we're going to suspend you if you persist with it. And why don't you just come back next year and do it properly? So he did. So as a result of that, for the next few years, then they did not allow any alternates to start if there was a situation where one could have. Well, they changed that in 1950 because Bob Laycock, who was the historian at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and he said that one of his early jobs was in 1950. He worked for a fellow named Snappy Ford, who was the publicity guy. And he said that his job was to stand down with the first alternate and the second alternate, which that year was Cliff Griffith and George Fonder. And they were both sitting there with their engines running. How'd you like to be in that situation? And Bob had to count them off and see that if any of the 33 couldn't get started, they were going to wave an alternate in. Well, then there were other years when the feeling was that when the field is set, that was it. And in the more recent years, they now do not name alternates because the thinking is because of the rule now that you can substitute a car in the case of a car having an accident in carburation, for instance, the fact that if you can't repair it, you could substitute another car, and then the fact that they now allow the driver switches, that the probably wouldn't be a scenario where there would be an opportunity for an alternate.
Oh,
so,
I see.
So that was part of the reason.
I guess I've been asleep for the past few years. I didn't
realize you have.
We did
okay.
Not have an alternate anymore.
Hey, Maya, thanks for the phone call.
Maya.
Thank you. Take care.
I appreciate that. Let's get to a quick email. This is from Alan listening in Louisville. Donald mentioned this driver while talking about the Jungle Land racetrack, and I have been captivated when seeing his name in the historic records. What can Donald tell us about Spider Webb?
Okay, let me, it was Jungle Park, by the way.
Yep.
And let me clarify this, that in 1984 and 1986, there were situations where an alternate came in.
Okay.
And that was when it happened in 84. And Chris Neifel, who was the first alternate starter, came in because Jacques Villeneuve, the uncle, had an accident in practice. And while somebody else could have been put in that car, an arrangement was made whereby the car would be withdrawn, and then Chris Neifel would go in as the first alternate. That was the first time since 1929 that an alternative had come in. And then it would happen 2 years later,
okay,
when Dennis Firestone was involved in a multi-car accident in the Carbruns and couldn't repair in time for the race. And so Dick Simon, who was the first alternative, came in and ran the race. All right, Jungle Park, Spider Web. Travis Webb was his name, and he drove in 6 Indianapolis 500s, and he never had a finish. His forte was sprint car racing. He was born in Joplin, Missouri.
As they say there, Missouri,
I think is the pronunciation. But I think Bell, California was where he was listed for most of the time, although he did live in Dayton. But he was a... he drove very successfully with CSRA, Central States Racing Association, and was actually offered cars at Indianapolis in the 1930s. And I met Spider Webb finally in 1973. And he said that he'd been offered cars, but he was making so much money, and that you would go to a race, you know, you unload, qualify, feature, take the money, go to the next race. And he said, you'd hang out a whole month at the Speedway. I could be off, you know, winning races and making money. But finally, in 1948, he came here for the first time, and he qualified in 48, 49, 50, 52, 53, and 54, and then did not make it in 55. In 52, he didn't enter because he was had an industrial injury, injured his hand. But he was one of those people that could qualify with very few laps. And he was the first, he was actually the first person in 1948 to qualify a car and get bumped and then get in another car and come back and get back in the field. He was the first person to do that. And there were several times when he would come in at the last minute and with very few laps, just, you know, get it in the show. But he was the Midwest Sprint Car Champion in 1948 and was just pretty much the king of the banks. Enjoyed a drink of an eve, as Johnny Parsons used to put it. And, you know, a kind of a, oh, I'd say a rough customer, but just a real character and a great interview. I'm very fortunate that I got to spend time with him. In fact, when I met him, and I'm sort of kind of inserting myself into this a little bit, I met him in 1973, and he thanked me, and it was because of the fact that in 1949, he had qualified a car and the transmission broke on race morning, which actually kind of fits in with the last question.
Yeah.
Where he couldn't start, and they realized like 2 or 3 hours before the start of the race, we've broke a transmission and we can't run. And so they never even went out to the grid and got 33rd, and there was a protest, but well, you know, you should have been able to put an alternate in. And anyway, so I don't remember what the situation was, but on the 500 broadcast 1 year, I had mentioned the fact that Spider Webb was 33rd without starting and what the reasons were. And so here we are several years later when I met him, and he had actually listened to the broadcast. And I, you know, you never know who's listening.
Right.
And he said, I want to thank you very much, because he said, I hadn't been around for quite a few years, and it was very nice to be remembered. I was listening to the broadcast and out in California and to hear my name over the air. So, again, you never know who's listening.
One of the many great stories we have had this evening. Time for a couple more of those when we come back from our final break. Phone lines are full, so if you're not on hold yet, we may not get to you this evening. And we probably won't have time to get to all of those on hold as it is now. But if you're there, stay there. We'll do our best to get to you in timely fashion. 239-1070 is the telephone number. You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 FM and 1070 The Fan.
The Talk of Gasoline Alley is brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice.
Welcome back for the final time this evening here on 107.5 FM and 1070 The Fan. Greg Rakestraw and Donald Davidson with you. Donald will be back alongside Kevin Lee tomorrow night at 8 o'clock for 1 hour. Before that, it'll be Trackside with Kevin and Kevin from 7 until 8 right here on 107.5 FM and 1070 The Fan. Before we get to a final phone caller or two, Donald has more about Travis Spider Webb.
All right, just a real quickie was the fact that I did mention that he enjoyed a drink of an eve, and once in a while he'd be at a racetrack on the Sunday morning, and it was sort of necessary to maybe take a nap.
Yes.
Anyway, so he actually told me, he said that that sometimes he wouldn't hot lap. And he would just qualify, and he said that he always had a good car, and he was driving for Johnny Vance. And he said Johnny Vance would come down, and he said, I would be taking a nap lying on the grass, and Johnny Vance would say, come on, it's time for hot laps. He said, hot laps? What does that pay? Wake me when it's time for qualifying. And then he would probably go out and break a track record.
What a great story. Well, I get a quick email from Brian, who says, I wanted to say thanks to Donald for coming next door to the radio room on the 9th floor and answering my Jim Herdebee's question earlier today. And my question is this. Since Sonny Meyer's stepson was in my wedding, and Sonny is my mother's neighbor in Crawfordsville, and most importantly, he's going into the Hall of Fame, does Donald have any other good stories about Sonny Meyer?
Oh, he just a delightful guy. He's Louis Meyer Jr., and he's smiling in most of the pictures. He came out of school and pretty much went straight to Meyer and Drake when Louis Meyer and Dale Drake bought the Offenhauser engine business in 1946. And so Louis sort of pretty much Sonny went out of school to straight into the business. So he was an engineer there, and then he was on crews. And then in 1958, he was a chief mechanic for the first time, and it was for Tony Bettenhausen. He was also, when we mentioned Troy Ruttman qualifying 33rd, that was Danny Oaks. But in 62, Troy Ruttman had a wonderful run where he started 30th and got up to second before dropping out like at 140 laps. And Sonny was the chief mechanic. In 64, my first year at the track, was the Shell Quavali MG Liquid Suspension Specials, and he was a mechanic for them. In 1964 was the year that Louis Meyer had an opportunity to be the distributor for the Ford racing engine, but he thought it was a conflict of interest to also be the Offey guy, so he sold out his interest to Dale Drake, and then Louis Meyer Incorporated was formed in order to be the Ford distributor. And where they did they have this incredible palace with, you know, hundreds of employees? It was actually at 30th and Georgetown. If you go to a lot of people remember where the laundry was, okay, on the corner in that little strip mall. Well, if you go down, there's a little garage that at one time was where that was the Ford distributorship. And before that, it was Racing Associates, and Foyt used to keep the Traco sprint car in there. Anyway, that's where they operated for quite a while, and they had dynos in there. And the reason for mentioning this is that Sonny sort of was there on a day-to-day basis. And I don't know how many people who went on to become chief mechanics went through Sonny, and so he was sort of like their mentor. And then he was the engine man for Patrick Racing Team. The estimate was that there have been approximately 15 winning Indianapolis engines that Sonny had either prepared or had an involvement with. And then all of the years for the V6 Buicks with John Menard, Sonny was the engine man. And I can tell you that he went on to the ballot. Several people suggested that he ought to be on the Hall of Fame ballot, and he was on for the first time this year, and he got in. he got the most votes of anybody in the pre 1970 and post 1970, I think is how it is. And he made it handsomely, and he's so thrilled, and will join his father in the Hall of Fame. And just another great guy.
All right, I tell you what, let's get to Jay in Bloomington. We have time for one question. We only have about 2 minutes left.
Okay.
So Jay, make it quick.
Hi, Jay. Donald. What you got?
My uncle Sheldon Kinzer was in the Indy 500 six times, and I'm his biggest fan, and grew up everywhere watching him race, and I just wanted to know what you thought of him.
Oh, I loved Sheldon. 2 minutes? I wish I could.
Well, how about we can lead off with Sheldon tomorrow night? How about that?
Well, all right, that'd be fine. No, Sheldon I liked very much, and I'll just say that he looked like he should have been a NASCAR driver, just big and strong, but actually he was not as big as he appeared. And he made that reference because I think he told me one time, he said he only weighed like 145, 150 pounds, but he looked like he was a much bigger man.
Yeah, he had a
great presence, and he had enormous hands. He and Rich Vogler had these enormous hands with fingers like sausages, but just a great sprint car driver, and he adapted very well to Indianapolis at a 6th and 81.
Jay, unfortunately, I have to kind of jump in here because we're up against it time-wise. We'll have to discuss more about this tomorrow night. Kevin will be back along with Donald tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Again, Trackside at 7, Talk of Gasoline Alley at 8 tomorrow night. Donald, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg. It was a pleasure as mine.
I want to thank to Ever Ready Teddy, as JMV calls him, for being our engineer on the program tonight. Thanks to Casey Valier back in the studios downtown Monument Circle in Indianapolis. Again, we'll have a full day of coverage of both what happened today and yesterday at the Motor Speedway, not to mention Pacers beating the Knicks, Pacers facing the Heat beginning on Wednesday night. It all starts tomorrow morning with Grady and Big Joe from 10 until noon, followed by Dan Dockett's JMV Trackside and the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Stay tuned. Major League Baseball is coming your way in a matter of moments. The field is set for the 97th running of the Indianapolis 500. Thank you for listening to FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.